from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. After Mexico's Attorney General, Jesus Murillo Caram, announced on Tuesday that the bodies found in the first of the mass graves discovered in the southern state of Guerrero were not those of 43 students who disappeared last month, an Argentinian forensic team of anthropologists said they could not yet conclusively determine if the bodies do or do not belong to the missing students. A spokesperson for the Argentinian team said they would have results within 3 weeks. The internationally renowned team from Argentina is collaborating on the investigation. They've reported that the Mexican authorities have impeded their work and that there exists some animosity between the groups. Four additional mass graves were discovered last week. Forensic identification of the bodies found in those graves is reportedly ongoing. There's been widespread confusion over the bodies found in the mass graves. Authorities in Guerrero said they were taken to the location of the graves by members of an organized crime group allegedly involved in the disappearance of the students. The governor of Guerrero, Aniel Aguirre, had originally told the media that some of the bodies were indeed those of the missing students. The attorney general's office quickly denied this. Meanwhile, the family members of the missing students stated publicly that they've never believed that the bodies found in the graves were those of the students. They and members of the movement that has sprung up to support them are demanding that the students be found and returned alive. The mayor, his wife, and the police chief of Iguala, the city where the students were attacked and disappeared, are considered suspects and are currently fugitives. Alistair Baverstock reports from Chilpancingo in Guerrero, Mexico.
The revelation that the 28 bodies found in a mass grave close to the town of Iguala and not those of the 43 students who disappeared at the hands of local police has further implicated the local authorities in collaboration with criminal cartels. On Monday, protesters from the Ayotzinapa College, among others, attempted to set fire to the state government building, following the governor's announcement on Sunday that the students had not been found in any of the mass graves. The residents of Guerrero state capital, Chilpancingo, claim not to be surprised, saying that the region has suffered for over 20 years under a police force which would disappear people with impunity.
The police and authorities here are openly corrupt and people go missing constantly. Everyone in this state has known about it for years. But if you speak out against the corruption, you go missing yourself. So people haven't spoken about it until now.
Guerrero state prosecutors believe that the local police turned the students over to a criminal drug gang after abducting them from the protest, leaving the drug gang to murder them. Human rights organization Amnesty International has taken issue with police corruption and brutality in Mexico.
A huge number of Mexicans live in fear of the authorities, and this is something that's a great issue. The police are there to protect people, not to terrorize them.
The discovery that the bodies found in the mass graves around Iguala are not those of the 43 missing students is a worrying fact for the ongoing scandal. The revelation means that not only are the students still missing, but that their disappearance only scratches the surface of a long history of violent crime here in Guerrero State. Alistair Baverstock, Chilpancingo.
Meanwhile, Benjamin Mondragon, the alleged head of United Warriors, the organized crime group allegedly tied to local government officials that is thought to be behind the disappearance of the students, reportedly committed suicide Tuesday as federal police surrounded his home. More protests and more arrests in Hong Kong on Wednesday when dozens of protesters blocked central streets. Some were pepper sprayed and some simply arrested. Meanwhile, officials made a suggestion to protesters that the Occupy movement here in the United States might have welcomed if it were made to them. We have this from China's CCTV.
Hong Kong Chief Executive Lung Chun-ying has released an online statement supporting the clearance of protesters from the streets. Lung said the protesters can move to public parks if they want to continue their demonstrations. The statement is posted on the Chief Executive blog, an official communication platform. Leung said the Occupy Central movement has had a severe influence on Hong Kong. Over the past weeks, traffic has been disrupted and people have to travel longer to get to work or school. The transportation industry has been hit heavily, and businesses around the occupied areas have suffered great losses. He said the SAR government and police have shown maximum tolerance to the protesters, but the disturbance to people's normal life cannot last indefinitely. Leung said the police will continue their work and restore normal traffic conditions.
Syria has rejected calls by Turkey to carve out a piece of Syrian territory as a buffer zone for Turkish troops to operate in, ostensibly to battle ISIS. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe had this report.
Syria has rejected calls for the creation of a buffer zone on its territory, saying it will treat any such action as an act of aggression. The Syrian Foreign Ministry says that Damascus will take all necessary measures to protect its sovereignty and territorial integrity. Turkey, which supports the downfall of the Syrian government, has repeatedly called for a buffer zone in northern Syria. Turkey has said that it will join the Western coalition against ISIL if such a buffer zone is carved out in northern Syria. Last week, the French President François Hollande also backed the idea. Kurdish fighters have taken more ground in fighting against Takfiri militants in the Syrian border city of Kobani. Field reports say that the Kurdish fighters have advanced in the east and the west of the war-torn city. Heavy clashes are underway between Kurdish fighters and the ISIL militants in the northwest of Kobani. A UK-based Syrian opposition group says that a U.S.-led airstrike targeted different parts of the city in the early hours of Wednesday. The war in the city has killed hundreds of residents and forced over 160,000 others to flee their homes over the past weeks. UN officials have warned that thousands of people will most likely be massacred if Kobani falls to the ISIL.
Those parts of Syria which border both Turkey and Iraq have seen much of the fighting with ISIS. RT's Paula Slyer toured the Kurdish region of northern Iraq, which also looks and feels like a war zone.
We have just passed through the Sahela checkpoint. This is now the war zone. This is ISIS territory. From here, we're driving towards the border town of Rabia. It's on the border of Iraq and Syria, and there has been intensive fighting happening there. Up until 3 days ago, that town was in the hands of ISIS. The other day, an ISIS fighter came out of one of these houses and started firing. So it's very possible that there's still ISIS fighters who've taken refuge in these houses and are hiding. We know from what the Peshmerga tell us that around 100 fighters were here. Most of them were killed by an airstrike and by the battle that took here. But not all of them have been accounted for, which means some of them are still missing and could be hiding in these houses or managed to run away.
Yesterday, two ISIS fighters came out alive. They were hiding in the air conditioning vents, but they were really hungry. They'd had no food or water for days, so they came out. One was firing a machine gun and refused to surrender, so we killed him. We sent the other to prison.
Now we are hearing firing, which is the Peshmerga firing against ISIS, which are, what I'm told, just 5 minutes down the road.
The first day we were here, we lost one of our Peshmerga fighters. There were 20 more ISIS fighters here, but we killed them all. Every once in a while, they still fire from these villages.
The smoke that you see behind me is from a house that the Peshmerga have exploded after finding some TNT inside, left behind by the ISIS fighters. Paula Slier, RT, on the front line, northern Iraq.
Turkey's failure to join the fight against ISIS has left the Kurds to face them alone. We have this report from RT.
Kurds in Turkey voiced their anger against Ankara for failing to step in and prevent the slaughter of Syrian Kurds at the hands of Islamic State. Protesters stormed a ferry in Istanbul to raise the alarm over civilian deaths in the city of Kobani. The group chanted their support for the Kurdish forces, and several arrests were made after fighting broke out between passengers and protesters.
And not only is Turkey not joining in the fight against ISIL, they've been bombing Kurdish fighters. Karba David reports from Suruç, Turkey.
On the hilltop of Suruç, the usual crowd has gathered. Turkish Kurds are watching the fighting in Kobani, worried, angry, and tense. Local reports Tuesday said that Turkish warplanes bombed fighters of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK rebels, in southeast Turkey near the Iraqi border. The PKK is designated as a terrorist organization by Turkey. Kurds have been fighting for self-rule in the region for three decades. The conflict has cost the lives of nearly 40,000 people. But in 2013, a peace process was initiated by the Turkish government and brought about a ceasefire. The ISIL assault on Kobani is jeopardizing that peace. PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan has threatened to pull out of the peace process over Turkey's perceived inaction in Kobani. Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu said Tuesday's strikes against the PKK came in retaliation to what he called repeated PKK harassment fire over the weekend at military outposts. Meanwhile, Kurds in Turkey are standing together in support of those in Kobani. This group of women has come to Suruç from the southeastern city of Diyarbakir to cheer Kurdish fighters here. They did not know anyone in this village, but were welcomed nevertheless. Local officials say the ISIL assault on Kobani has indeed united all Kurds.
This attack by ISIS on Kurds has united us from all four divided regions, from Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Syria. It has brought us all together. We are all now supporting each other.
With the intense fighting in Kobani and with warnings both from Turkey and the PKK, difficult days are certainly expected on both sides of the Turkish-Syrian border. Mikhail Bardavid, CCTV, Suruç, Turkey.
The U.S. corporate press has stepped up its attacks on Venezuela, which is due to take a seat on the U.N. Security Council next year. We spoke with Danny Haifong, a columnist with Black Agenda Report, whose piece on the question, Strangling the Axis of Resistance, Corporate Media Bashes Venezuela's Maduro to Get to Syria, was published last week.
Venezuela is up for a U.N. Security Council seat. The corporate media came out swinging on Venezuela, as it usually does whenever it is either trying to discredit for Venezuela for its own purposes of regime change in that country, or whether Venezuela is posing a threat internationally. And right now, Venezuela is set to be on the UN Security Council 2015, and this means that even though it won't have a vote on the Security Council, it will have a platform to further strengthen what I call the axis of resistance in the globe, which includes Russia, China, Syria, Iran, and Venezuela, as well as many Latin American countries that are really telling the truth about what the U.S. and its so-called coalition of the willing is doing in the region.
You know, this month, October, the chair of the Security Council is the permanent representative from Argentina. Well, Argentina formerly holds the chair of the Security Council. The permanent representative from Argentina said, by the way, there's some items that are on the agenda this month that we want to talk about. One has to do, of course, with the sovereign debt issue that Argentina is facing. But one was very interesting, the ongoing discussion about structural reformation of the UN, the Security Council, and all of that, which has been on the table for more than 50 years. And she said, when I took over the package for this month, I see that there's no institutional memory of this ongoing process, so we're going to start it now. So in other words, going forward, there's going to be a file on reforming the UN to be handed to whoever handles the agenda the following month so it can be done continuously. So you can do things from there even without a vote, and Venezuela will be in line to chair next year if they get on the Security Council.
Yeah, and that is a real dangerous development for imperialism, because as President Maduro made clear that in his speech to the UN General Assembly, Venezuela is by and far against what imperialism is doing all over the planet. But Maduro made a special point to make note that he believes, as well as the Bolivarian Revolution as a whole, believes that the United States and its allies are responsible for the crisis of ISIS in the Middle East and is the true sponsorship of terrorism in the world. And Venezuela has a very special relationship to this, because earlier in 2014, Venezuela was going through a heightened struggle with U.S.-backed fascists that receives much of its money from the National Endowment for Democracy and similar nonprofits, as well as funneled CIA money and direct money from Congress. So Venezuela has a special stake and understands what solidarity really means. And they also represent an example. They're an example to the world of what a different social system looks like.
Right.
That's another reason why the United States and the corporate media really came out against Venezuela. And this is what they do a lot whenever Venezuela becomes important enough to bash. You know, the Washington Post called Maduro an economically illiterate bus driver and demanded the Obama administration do their best to stop Venezuela's bid. At this point, imperialism is too weak to influence the Caribbean and Latin America as it would like. So Washington has even resigned to admitting that, yeah, we'll probably have to take this one in the chin. But that does not mean that they won't do everything they can to try to delegitimize Venezuela as they've been doing since the Bolivarian Revolution's beginnings.
Yeah, well, at the Security Council, there's definitely some dangers for the United States. And you point out, particularly in Syria, what has stopped the United States thus far from doing a replay of the Libyan scenario was the vetoes several times by Russia and China of enabling resolutions for the U.S. to do airstrikes. The airstrikes are an absolutely necessary component of the war that their proxies are conducting on the ground. Without Security Council authority, airstrikes are illegal. And if you have everyone on the Security Council willing to play ball, even if you're going to be facing vetoes, if it's all but two, Russia and China on one side and Russia and China on the other, that's an entirely different message to the world than a divided Security Council on illegal actions by the U.S.
You know, Russia and China admit that it was a mistake to abstain from the vote in Libya, and we've seen the consequences of what U.S. imperialism did there. And the U.N. Security Council now is a struggle between imperialism versus the multipolar order and the sovereign countries of the world trying to defend themselves from a U.S.-led proxy war. What's happening in Kobani right now is really interesting because the whole airstrike campaign by the Coalition of the Willing completely subverts the U.N. Security Council and is by any definition of international law, an illegal undertaking. But because they've bypassed the UN Security Council, they're seeing their actions as completely legal. But this airstrike campaign that they're conducting now sort of legitimizes the resistance Axis's position all along. The axis of imperialism, that is the Coalition of the Willing, they're crumbling, and they are heavily divided right now on the question of ISIS. And so it's really interesting that the corporate media would come out so blatantly opposed to Venezuela's international position in the world at this juncture.
Right.
And it really shows how weak imperialism is at this point. I think Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report says it a lot when he covers issues of imperialism. He says that brutality and sort of the mad dog scorched earth policy that imperialism is conducting against ISIS and all over the planet is really a sign of weakness.
Right.
And sort of what the corporate media is doing as a mouthpiece of Washington is another sign of weakness.
Yeah.
It's finding a really difficult time to lend itself legitimacy. And right now, my piece was all about ensuring that, you know, Venezuela's sovereignty is upheld in any platform that we can do, because we need to build an anti-imperialist movement here.
I mean, for the American media to even cover the Security Council, absent some major international crisis going on, makes one scratch their heads. Oh, we don't want Venezuela to be on the Security Council. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Who's on the Security Council? Most people have no idea. It gets zero coverage ever. And then, and then suddenly this is something that you have to pull out all the stops to prevent. It's a non sequitur in terms of the narrative.
Yeah, definitely. The this whole idea that Washington should, as the Washington Post put it, stop Venezuela from being able to sit on UN Security Council is just a blatant sign of how arrogant imperialism is and how it believes it should control world affairs in its own interests. And, you know, what we're seeing here is that if anything doesn't go imperialism's way, even when it comes to their allies, because Turkey's up for a seat on the UN Security Council, and Turkey is, for a long time in this proxy war against Syria, has been a friend of the United States, has supplied a whole border region for the proliferation of the proxy war, and is responsible for ISIS. But now that imperialism, that U.S. imperialism, has to put on this veneer of being at war with ISIS, Turkey's policy of being so hands-off and supportive, openly supportive of ISIS, is creating a PR disaster for the United States. And that's why Biden was caught saying that Turkey and Saudi Arabia and the allies of the region are complicit in ISIS's creation, because there's a PR crisis going on right now, and the more that the U.S.'s allies are being exposed as supporting ISIS and supporting the bankrupt imperial policies abroad, the more that the United States becomes exposed all around the world, and especially to the American people, who already don't support another war. But without the fear of ISIS, there is no way that they can conduct their direct intervention that they eventually want to. So there's a huge crisis right now in imperialism, and if Venezuela is able to step in there and change the narrative, any bit of the narrative, it becomes an even huger PR crisis.
Yeah, I mean, to those who don't know, when if they, you know, the few out of the general public that look at UN Security Council meetings, and which we cover that stuff, but most media outlets don't. You know, you're looking at countries like Lithuania, when the United States, you know, says Russia, you know, was evil, that needs to be countered, and blah 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 at the Security Council. Australia is there. First, you have the UK and France among the permanent members. Then you had, you know, this year Australia, Lithuania, you know, Luxembourg, Rwanda, which has actual war criminals in the in the government, Republic of Korea. All these, you know, basically, if they're not U.S. colonies, they're U.S. client states, lining up, you know, head bobbing in unison with the United States. If you get some dissent there, and you have an actual conversation, actual controversies, God forbid that that should ever get before the American public, and they find out that there is not a unanimity of opinion that's portrayed on the news.
Yeah, the entrance and the strength, I think, of the axis of resistance that is deepening, the solidarity that is deepening between Russia, China, Iran, Syria, and, you know, to have Latin America represented by Venezuela, because Venezuela is leading the way in terms of its 21st century socialist movement, the Bolivarian Revolution.
Regional integration.
Leading the way in terms of the path that Latin America, the majority of Latin American people want to go in. And that sharpens the contradiction within the institution of the UN, which has historically worked for imperialism masterfully and hasn't been an impediment to imperialism. But now, as it begins to weaken and as it begins to precipitate its own demise and its own enemies, and as more and more nations leaders start moving towards the right side of history, the UN becomes a battlefield, and that's what it is right now. And the United States knows it. So whatever Washington says, that they've resigned to Venezuela, this and that, to have the Washington Post, which by all accounts has been a useful mouthpiece for a long time for the United States, come out with a whole editorial piece about why Venezuela shouldn't be on the UN Security Council, is a pretty clear indication that U.S. imperialism does care. It does care about Venezuela. It's right now trying to conduct regime change there. It's just not in the corporate media right now, because there's some bigger fish to fry, and there's some crises going on elsewhere that, for them, deserve more attention.
Yeah, you know, there are folks in Washington who understand quite clearly the threat. If you look at the role that Venezuela has played in the complete transformation of Latin America, the Caribbean, in terms of regional integration, in terms of an assertion by an integrated region of national and regional sovereignty as against the United States, with the experimentation of mixed economies, heavy doses of socialism in a number of countries, even with neoliberal governments, just compelled by the general motion of the region to, you know, indulge in these different relationships and experiments with property relations. That experiment that started in 1998 here, with Venezuela at the center, the creation of ALBA and all these other regional organizations, spawned BRICS, which incorporated Brazil, and is now reproducing itself almost as a global confederation of such regional organizations. And you're seeing the same kind of activity now starting in Africa.
Yeah.
So the potential there has, you have two members, permanent members of the Security Council in that block, half the human population, and China's economy and Russia's nuclear weapons.
Yeah, it's a scary alliance for imperialism, a real scary one. You know, this what's happening in Latin America is also really important to what's happening in Syria, in the region, that imperialism is so scared of its policies being exposed in. You know, Venezuela's example is a culmination of a long struggle that began after the Cuban Revolution. And after the Cuban Revolution, when Che said, you know, we want to make one, two, three, many Vietnams, we want to reproduce what's happening in Cuba, around Latin America, and there was an active movement to do that, there was a huge response by Western financial institutions, by the United States itself, to prop up military dictatorships, to create huge social strife that murdered many tens of thousands of people in Central America and Latin America, and that really cemented the grip of the IMF and the World Bank institutions that looted Latin America for so long. And it wasn't until the 1980s where there was this huge response to austerity that led to Venezuela's Hugo Chavez and the Chavista movement taking power. And now we're seeing that this movement is gaining traction all over Latin America, and despite the fact that a lot of the governments remain neoliberal and have not been pushed by the popular movements there as much as maybe might be hoped, the potential is there because Venezuela is growing stronger and it's withholding and maintaining strength despite the U.S.-backed attacks that are probably going to happen there seasonally until something else changes. And, you know, the gains that they've made have brought a pretty large consensus in the region that the correct direction of history is towards a more integrated region, is towards a socialist economic base, it's towards the idea that workers, oppressed people, should have the power to determine their own destiny. These are ideas that are not new.
Right.
But in the 21st century, they are most represented in Venezuela and the remaining resistance axis. And so if those ideas start catching fire in Venezuela, if the ideas of Russia and China's demand for sovereignty all over the world catches fire, this creates an obstacle to imperialism that it hasn't really faced since the Soviet period.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.